Book of 2 Kings. And while you're turning there, let me ask you a question. How many of you have ever seen an outcome that was completely unexpected before? That was completely and utterly unexpected. Maybe the circumstances leading up to it were just something that you said, this will never happen. This could never occur. I experienced one of those one time. Growing up, I was homeschooled, and I would play baseball at the local field. It was called the Spencer League, and we would go over there and we'd play. But they only ran from first grade to sixth grade, and I didn't have a school that I could go play for at the time, so I was kind of out of options. I didn't really know what I was going to do playing baseball after that. Well, there was a Christian school near where I lived. It was called North Hills Christian School. And they needed some people to fill the roster for their baseball team. And so they were reaching out to some of the families that played in the Spencer League. And my family was one of the ones they contacted. And so they said, hey, we really want you and your brother to come play for our team. And we're like, this is awesome. This is great, because neither of us had a place where we could play at the time. And this was an opportunity for us. And so we go there and we're all excited. And my brother and I didn't have the nicest gear. We didn't have all the fancy equipment and stuff. But we said, we're going to go here and we're going to give our very best effort. And we show up. And boy, what a team that was. This was the single worst team I have ever witnessed, much less even been a part of. The first game of the season, we got mercy ruled in 3 innings, as did the rest of the season. Every single game, we would score no runs. Very few people would get a hit, if any. It was just absolutely awful. And so we lost one game after the other, after the other, after the other. Mercy rule. The scores would be 25-0, 32-0, 23-0. This is baseball, not football. And so we were getting mercy ruled every single game, and it was awful. It was terrible. It was super disheartening. Well, towards the end of the season, we were just very dejected, very sad, and we just were not doing well. Well, one time we find a team that's almost as bad as we are, which was a miracle in and of itself. And so we find this team and we're playing a game, and we actually start like hitting the ball and we start making plays. And then the end of the game comes and it's close. We're only down by one run. We have a runner on second base and first base, and it looks like we have a chance. But the worst batter in our lineup comes up. Now, when I say this guy was the worst batter, I mean, he was the worst batter, objectively, no comparison. He had no hits. He had not put any balls in play the entire season. I don't think he'd actually made contact with a pitch the entire season this whole year round. And so at this point, we're just very discouraged, and we're literally in the dugout packing our bags up because the game's about to end as this guy's walking up to bat. And so the first pitch goes by, and it's a strike, and he doesn't hit it. And then the second pitch goes by, and it's a strike, and he doesn't hit it. And at this point, we're like, well, he's probably not going to walk. He's probably not going to get a hit. This game is completely over. It's going to end our season. We're not going to progress any further after this. And so we're just packing our bags, and we're not even paying attention at this point. And so I'm reaching into my bag, and I'm just like putting some stuff into my bag, and I hear, dink! And I look up, and I see this guy running, and he had actually hit the ball. And everyone, like all 20 fans that were there, they absolutely go ballistic. Like, we are losing our minds over this guy getting a hit. And it goes, it's just a little piddly dribbler that goes straight to the shortstop. And so everyone's losing their mind that this guy has made contact with the ball. And so he's running off to first base, and everyone in the back of their mind, they're like, we know this guy's going to get out. We know there's no way he's making it to first base with this shortstop there, because the shortstop's got a cannon for an arm. And so the shortstop comes running up to this little dribbler, and he goes to scoop it. And as he scoops it, the ball just kind of tips off the end of his glove and pops up in the air, and then it drops back down. And so then he's panicking, and so he tries to pick it up again, and he drops it again. And so our runner starts going towards first base, and the throw gets there, but not in time to get him out. And I tell you, that dugout was going insane. Like, you thought it was the World Series. We're all losing our minds. This guy had got a hit. Now, during that time, while the shortstop's fumbling with his ball, all he's focused on is getting the ball to first base. He does not care about any other base runners. So we score a run. This ties the game. And then, because this guy was our very worst batter, he's at the very end of the lineup, our next guy comes up, he ends up getting a base hit, and we ended up winning the game. And it was the most astonishing, like, could not believe it had ever happened. We still lost the season. We didn't even make playoffs. But that game felt like the World Series, because we had come back from the jaws of defeat, and we won that game. It was the most improbable outcome that could have happened. No one would have predicted that that man would have scored the final run, that he would have hit the ball that would have put us in a position, kept us going, and we would have won the game. In the book of 2 Kings chapter 7, we're going to see another story where the most improbable possible outcome takes place, but it was one that was predicted. Everyone in this story says there's no way this is going to happen. There's no way that the story will end this way, except for one man. He said, it's going to happen. He said, you just watch. It's going to happen. And so we're going to look at that story tonight. So we're in the book of 2 Kings chapter 7. And what we're going to learn tonight is also a reflection of this morning is trusting in God. Is trusting in God even when things do not seem probable. In order to understand this passage, you need to understand the context first. First thing is that Israel has been at war with these raiders that came from Syria. Now, the Syrians would have came from the east, and they would have invaded the land of Israel. And they're having one military defeat after another. They're not making a lot of progress at this time. This is because Elisha is spoiling all of their plans. The Lord is revealing the plans of the Syrians to Elisha, and Elisha is forwarding this information to the king of Israel, which at the time was Jehoram. And so, every time the Syrians are planning to make a move, Elisha is one step ahead of them. He literally knows their plans. And if you read chapter 6 in the book of 2 Kings, the king of Syria, or the leader of this group of Syrian raiders, literally says, he says, someone in here is a traitor. He said, someone in our camp is spoiling our secrets and our plans and everything to the Israelites, and that's the reason why we're failing. He says, so I want you guys to go out, and you're going to kill this man, whoever this spy is. And they have this thought. They say, well, we've heard rumors about this guy that lives in Israel. And this man that lives in Israel is rumored to be a prophet, that he has information from God, and he's spoiling the records. And so they go to kill Elisha. And this is the story where Elisha's city is surrounded by the warriors. And Elisha's servant wakes up, and he sees everybody, and he starts to panic because certain and impending doom is upon them. And Elisha says, whoa, 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 it's okay. He says, you're seeing the enemy all around us. He says, but you're not seeing God's protection. And so the Lord opens this young man's eyes, and he sees the angels surrounding them. He sees that they are being protected by God. And immediately after this, Elisha calls on the Lord to strike these men with blindness, and they're struck with blindness. And then he takes all of these soldiers captives, and he leads them into Israel. And the king's like, good, let's kill them here. And Elisha's, whoa, whoa, whoa. He says, let's not do that. He says, would you kill your captives of any other war? He said, give them some food and then send them on their way. And so they do. And because the Israelites treated them with kindness that they completely did not deserve, they leave. And they say, we're not going to invade Israel anymore for the time being. Well, after they do this, the Syrians then move on to Samaria. They say, well, if we're not going to take Israel, we're going to take Samaria instead. And so it says that they begin a siege in Samaria. And this is where the context really clues in for our passage tonight. Verse 24 of chapter 6. And it came to pass after this that Ben-Hadad, king of Syria, gathered all his hosts and went up and besieged Samaria. Now, a siege is where an enemy army would encapsulate a city or a nation, something like that, and they would not allow any food to go into this city. It's war by starvation. In the Middle Ages, they would surround the castle, and they wouldn't attack. They wouldn't launch stuff at them yet. They would just sit there and wait. Because eventually the food supplies in the city or the castle would run out, and the people in there would get desperate. They'd get weakened. They'd run out of resources and supplies, and they would either starve to death, they would surrender, or they would have to come out and fight, but they are already in a weakened state. And so it gives the attacker an advantage. And this is what Samaria is trying to do here to Israel. They have surrounded Samaria, and they're not letting any food into the city. Verse 25, there was a great famine in Samaria. This is a man-made famine. This isn't a famine as a result of a lack of rain or as the locust or some other crop that destroys everything. This famine is caused by the Syrians. And behold, they besieged it until, it says, an ass's head was sold for 40 pieces of silver and the fourth part of a cab of dove's dung for 5 pieces of silver. Now, you need to understand these measurements here. A shekel, in today's monetary standard, the word for shekel used here would be around $8 to $10 would be the value of it. It says 1/6 of a seah, or like this very small portion, very, very small portion of dove's dung would be sold for 5 shekels. Now, scholars have argued back and forth of what this actually means. Some people believe that dove's dung refers to a very small and undesirable grain. It was very coarse. It didn't have a lot of flavor. It didn't have a lot of, like, taste. It was very fibrous and kind of rooty. And that's what they believe it's referring to here. It could also be that they're literally eating bird poop because they're starving to the point where they have no resources left in this city. Either one of these is entirely possible. It also says that a donkey's head, like the least desirable portion of the donkey, is also being sold for just this extraordinary amount of money. And so you can see that the famine here is getting very, very, very bad. And people are getting extremely desperate just to have something to eat. Well, the king is not isolated from this. It says, and the king of Israel was passing by upon the wall, and there cried a woman unto him, saying, help, my lord, O king. And so the king is passing along the walls. Now, the walls of a city were typically the least desirable portions to live in. You wouldn't want to live by the wall because that's going to be the first place that's attacked by the enemy. And so he's kind of going around to the outskirts of the city, just examining how the people are doing, kind of getting a feel for the situation. And we have this woman here that is begging him for help. She's begging him earnestly just to relieve her in some way. And he said in verse 27, if the Lord do not help thee, whence shall I help thee? Out of the barn floor or out of the wine press? He says, look, he says, I'm no better off than you are. He says, how am I supposed to help you when we don't even have enough? He says, unless God is going to do something for you, nothing is going to happen for you because there's nothing left here. The city is scraping the bottom of the barrel just to get by. And the king says, I have no help to offer you. And he says, and the king said unto her, verse 28, what aileth thee? And this is one of the most tragic passages in all of Scripture. And she answered, she said, this woman said unto me, so there's two women here. The other woman says, give me thy son that we may eat him today, and then tomorrow we'll eat my son. And so they are at the point of such depravity in this city that they're willing to eat their own children. The woman says, hey, we'll eat your son today, and then don't worry, I'm going to sacrifice too. We'll eat my son tomorrow. And then notice what happens next. And it came to pass, and so we boiled my son and did eat him. And I said unto her the next day, give me thy son that we may eat him. And she hath hither her son. And so this day they ate the second woman's child. They're so hungry, they're so starving to death that they ate this child. And then the next day comes around and the other woman's hit her child. So she was willing to eat someone else's child, but she spared her own. And so this woman is mourning, assuredly because she's lost her son, but also because even her closest neighbors have betrayed her. The city has no help to offer her. She can't get help from the king. She can't get help from the other citizens. And this extreme example of depravity in the city paints an accurate picture of where they're at. These people are resorted to eating the undesirable parts of animals, to eating things that are inedible, to having to resort to cannibalism in this point. They are at the very last shreds of hope of survival at this point. And this makes the king angry. And it came to pass when the king heard the words of this woman that he rent his clothes. And he passed by upon the wall, and the people looked, and behold, he had sackcloth within upon his flesh. You think of a picture of leadership in a time of trouble. If you look at the president of Ukraine, you see all these pictures of him wearing like the military vest, and he's going around to all these different war zones, and he's interacting with the troops. He's trying to give a position of power. He's saying, hey, I'm in this conflict with you. He's reassuring his citizens. At this point, the king is also in mourning. He's going around the city, and he's wearing sackcloth. He himself is showing just the stress that's going on in this city, and the people see him. And this makes him angry. He says, God, how could you do this to us? How could you allow us to suffer so greatly to the point where these women are cannibalizing children? Then he said, God do so and more to me, or more also to me, if the head of Elisha, the son of Shaphat, shall stand upon him this day. And so he begins to take out his anger on Elisha. He's thinking, if Elisha had done something, if the man of God had done something, this whole situation could have been avoided. We wouldn't be in this mess if Elisha did something. And so now he's going to turn his back on Elisha, and he's going to send someone to go kill him. Verse 32, but Elisha sat in his house, and the elders sat with him, and the king sent a man from before him. But before the messenger came to him, he said to the elders, see ye how the son of a murderer hath sent to take away mine head? Look, when the messenger cometh, shut the door, and hold him fast at the door. Is it not the sound of his master's feet behind him? And so this messenger starts coming to Elisha, and the Lord reveals to Elisha that this messenger is going to come and kill him if they let him in. And so Elisha, knowing this ahead of time, he tells the other men that are in the house with him, he says, hey, he says, lock the door, don't let this guy in, he's going to try to kill me. And he has an intention. His intention here is to bring my head to the king. Verse 33, and while he yet talked with them, behold, the messenger came down unto him and said, behold, this evil is of the Lord. What should I wait for the Lord any longer? And so the messenger is relaying the king's message. The messenger says, look, we're tired of waiting on God. We're tired of believing that God is going to deliver us from the situation. It's completely improbable. There's no way that God's going to spare us. We are at the very end of our strength. We have no resources left. God has abandoned us. God has left us. God is not going to take care of us anymore. And notice what Elisha says. So this is what happens next. Elisha demonstrates great faith. Then Elisha said, hear ye the word of the Lord. Thus saith the Lord, tomorrow, about this time, shall a measure of fine flour be sold for a shekel, and two measures of barley for a shekel, in the gate of Samaria. So Elisha declares that great prosperity is going to come to Samaria. Now you have to understand at what point this is taking place. These people are literally reduced to eating inedible plants, and eating bird poop, and eating inedible parts of animals just to stay alive. And he's saying that great prosperity is going to be in the marketplace tomorrow. What? How is this going to take place? How could this possibly happen? And then notice what he's saying here. He says a measure or a seah, so 6 to 8 pounds of this super fine flour, this ultra desirable flour, this would have been the cream of the crop, the very best. He said this stuff's going to be cheap. It's going to be just as cheap as if you were buying sand. And then he says that you're going to be able to buy two measures of barley or several days worth of barley for a single day's wages. Now, at this point, that sounds awesome. He's saying food is going to be in abundance. He says we are going to crash the economy of food because there's going to be so much food here. And this just sounds completely improbable. No one would expect that this would be the case. How in the world could God possibly provide the food necessary for such an economic burst to take place? And so Elisha demonstrates great faith. He says, look, he says, don't worry. He says, tomorrow the Lord's going to answer every one of your prayers. The Lord is going to take care of you. He's going to provide your needs. And then we see verse 2. We see another man's faith, or lack thereof. Then a lord, or an officer, on whose hand the king leaned, answered the man of God. So this was a person that the king depended on for guidance. This was someone that the king trusted for wisdom, trusted for economic prosperity, someone who would have been in charge of overseeing the wealth of this city. And so the person in charge of all these resources, the one that the king puts a lot of faith in, says this. He says, behold, if the Lord would make windows in heaven, he said, might this thing be? You can hear the sarcasm in his voice as he's saying this. He says, yeah. He says, okay. He said, God's going to open a window, and from the sky is going to drop all this amazing food that you're talking about. He says, this is complete baloney. There's no way that God's going to do this, and there's no way that what you're saying is true. We should have just killed Elisha from the get-go. And so this man demonstrates no faith whatsoever that the Lord is going to take care of his people. And he said, this is speaking of Elisha, behold, thou shalt see it with thine eyes, but shalt not eat thereof. He said, and he speaks to this officer, the one that's like basically called Elisha a joke in front of the king, in front of the courtroom. He says, yeah. He says, you'll see this happen. You'll see the day that the Lord brings prosperity to this land. He says, but you're not going to enjoy it. Keep that in mind. That comes back later. All right. So now we see the improbable part of this. Verse 3, and there were four leprous men at the entering in of the gate. And they said one to another, why sit we here until we die? Now, I believe that these are four of the most intelligent men in Scripture because they are in the midst of this horrific situation, and they just take a super logical approach. They just look at their situation. They say, why are we just sitting here waiting to die? Now, you have to understand who the lepers were. The lepers were the outcasts of the city. These were the people that no one would have looked to for a solution. These were the people that had been rejected by society. They weren't allowed to interact with the rest of the public. And so they would sit at the gates of these large cities waiting for people to come in, and they would beg for money. They would, because they didn't have the opportunity to work. They couldn't provide for themselves. They were sick. Their bodies are decaying. And they said, why are we just sitting here until we die? And then notice their logic and reasoning in verse 4. If we say we will enter into the city, then the famine is in the city, and we will die. So they say, if we stay here, we're just going to starve to death. But they said, and if we sit, now therefore come, let us fall into the host of the Syrians. If they save us alive, we shall live, and if they kill us, we shall but die. So they said, look, we're going to starve here and die anyways. We have certain death guaranteed if we stay in the city, so we might as well at least go out there and try to talk to them. So their plan is to go out and talk to the Syrians. Maybe they're going to beg. Maybe they'll sell themselves into slavery. Maybe they'll be servants or whatever. But their plan is to go out there and try to sweeten up the Syrians and try to talk to them so that they can finally have some food and not starve to death. And so this is a good example of when you don't know what to do next. You just take the next logical step. So often in life, we sit around waiting for this. We view God's will as this mystic, like floating being that goes around and guides us into what we need to do. But God's will guides us, and he has given us logic and reasoning. And so these men are sitting here. They evaluate their situation. They say, look, we are going to die if we stay here. Therefore, any other alternative is better than this, that we might live. And so they say, you know what? We're just going to go. We're going to go talk to the Syrians and see what happens here. In verse 5, and they rose up in the twilight, or early in the morning, to go to the camp of the Syrians. And when they were come to the uttermost parts of the camp of Syria, behold, there was no man there. And so these four lepers, they wake up early, they're putting their plan into action, and they go to this camp where the Syrians are. They know that there's a good chance when they get there, they're just going to be killed on the spot. But they go just on the chance that the Syrians will let them. But when they get there, this huge army is totally gone. There's no one left in the camp of the Syrians, and here's why. Verse 6, for the Lord had made the host of the Syrians to hear a noise of chariots and a noise of horses, even the noise of a great host. And they said to one another, lo, the king of Israel hath hired against us the kings of the Hittites and the kings of the Egyptians to come upon us. And so the Syrians in this camp, they start hearing all these noises. The Lord provided those noises, and they start hearing this. They're like, oh my goodness, this huge army is coming, and they're going to wipe us out. They're going to kill all of us. And so the Syrians begin to panic. And it says in verse 7, wherefore they arose and fled in the twilight and left their tents and their horses and their asses, even the camp as it was, and they fled for their life. So they don't take their wealth with them. They don't take all their money and their fine clothes. They don't take food. They don't take their tents. They leave everything, and they just completely get out of Dodge. And this is what the lepers walk up on. Now, this is like an amazing story. So the lepers get up here in verse 8. And when these lepers came to the uttermost part of the camp, they went into one tent and did eat and drink and carried thence silver and gold and raiment and went and hid it. And then they go back to the next tent and entered another tent and carried thence also and went and hid it. And so they keep doing this. They just walk into this camp and it's like going into Walmart and everything is free. Everything is free in there. And they're just looking at this camp. No one's there to stop them. No one is forbidding them. And you have to understand, these were the poorest of the poor in this city. They had no resources at all. So if the king is suffering and these other people are suffering, these people are at the very bottom of the barrel. They are underneath the barrel. And then they're presented with all this food. And so they're starving men at an all-you-can-eat buffet, and they go in, and they're just eating all this food they can get, and they're drinking all this stuff, and they're just loading themselves up with silver and gold, and then they carry it off, and they bury it somewhere, and then they come back, and they get some more. And it's just incredible, and they keep going back one to another. And then verse 9 says, and they said one to another, we do not well. They said, all right, this isn't smart. This day is a day of good tidings, and we hold our peace. If we tarry till the morning light, some mischief will come upon us. So they say, look, this is good, but we got to play this smart. If we're still here in the morning and the Syrians decide to come back, they're going to kill us all. Or maybe the Lord's going to strike us down for being greedy. And so they start reasoning with themselves. They say, okay, we need to go back. We need to tell everybody else about this before something bad happens to us. Strength in numbers. Now therefore come that we may go and tell the king's household. So they came and called unto the porter of the city, or the person that would have been in charge for who came and went from the city. And they told them, saying, we come to the camp of the Syrians, and behold, there was no man there, neither voice of man, but horses tied and asses tied, and the tents as they were. So these four lepers come to the city, and the porter's like, hey, whoa, whoa. He's like, you guys aren't allowed to be with the rest of the public. You guys are not supposed to be here because you guys are contagious. You're filled with disease. He said, what do you guys want? And they tell this ridiculous story that all the Syrians just left their camp, left all of their stuff behind, and they said, we came back. Now, you can imagine the porter of the city would have been like, okay, cool story, guys, but that's not really happening. There's no way he would have believed them. But just based on the depravity of the situation that they have no options left, the porter thinks, okay, well, I'll go tell this to the king and we'll see what happens. And he called the porters, and they told the king's house we're in. And the king arose in the night and said unto his servants, I will now show you what the Syrians have done to us. They know that we be hungry. Therefore are they gone out of the camp to hide themselves in the field, saying, when they come out of the city, we will catch them alive and get into the city. So the king himself doesn't believe this story. He says, look, this is what the Syrians are actually doing. He says, they've set a trap for us. He says, they've left their camp empty. They've left all this wonderful food and drink. They've left all this wealth and riches. It's like a trap. You guys ever seen like in the cartoons where someone's got a big cardboard box and a stick under it, and then they're waiting by with a string? He's like, that's the picture that the Syrians are doing right here. He said, they have left this pile of bait here, and as soon as our starving citizens make their way into this camp, they're going to come through and just kill all of us. He's like, we're going to be like lambs to the slaughter. He said, there's no way we're going to survive this. So the king doesn't believe them. The porters probably don't believe them. But then notice what happens then. So then one of his servants answered and said, let some take, I pray thee, 5 of the horses that remain. So there's not many horses left because they ate the rest of them, which are left in the city. Behold, there is the multitude of Israel that are left in it. And then it continues on in verse 14 that they took 2 chariot horses, and the king sent after the host of the Syrians, said, go and see. So this one porter says, look, he says, it's got to be worth at least a chance. He says, I know it's improbable. It's probably a trap. He says, but we can at least afford to send a few people out there just to see if this is even true, because we have nothing left. We have no options at all. And so they send them in verse 15, and they went after them unto Jordan, and lo, the way, so the path where the Syrians had left is full of garments and vessels, which the Syrians had cast away in their haste. And the messengers returned and told the king. And the people went out and spoiled the tents of the Syrians. So a measure of fine flour was sold for a shekel, and 2 measures of barley for a shekel, according to the word of the Lord. And so they go out there, they confirm that the leper story is true, and then they go back and they tell everybody, and the people of the city just go, whoosh. I want you to think of like Black Friday, right? Like back before online shopping was a thing. Everyone's going out there and they are just raiding this camp. They're getting all the food they can. They're getting all the gold they can. I mean, this is the best thing that's ever happened to these people. The Lord has provided above and beyond their needs in exactly the same way that he said he would. Just as God had promised, God has provided. But that's not the end of the story. Verse 17, and the king appointed the Lord on whose hand he leaned on. So that officer, you remember from the start of the story, the officer that made the sarcastic comment said, yeah, if God would open a big hole in the sky and let everything just fall upon us, then this story would happen. That same character comes back at the end of the story. And so the king says, you know what? We need some way to regulate all of this stuff that's being taken into the city. He says, so I want you to go to the gate and you're going to let the people out so that they can go get some food. And so he sets him at the gate, and it says, and the people trode upon him in the gate, and he died, as the man of God had said, who spake when the king came down to him. And so Elisha had prophesied that this man would die. He said, you're going to see all this wealth. He says, but you won't enjoy any of it. And so this officer goes to the gates of the city, and he opens up the gates in order to let the people. And it said the people literally ran him over. They trampled him to death just trying to get out to this food. Because you got to think, they're starving. These people are super, super hungry, and they see the food out there. They don't care about this guy. They don't care about anybody in their way. They just have to get to the food. And so he dies. And it came to pass, as the man of God had spoken to the king, saying, 2 measures of barley for a shekel and a measure of fine flour for a shekel shall be tomorrow about this time in the gate of Samaria. And the Lord answered the man of God and said, now, behold, if the Lord should make windows in heaven, might such a thing be? And he said, behold, thou shalt see it with thine eyes, but shalt not eat thereof. And so it fell out unto him, for the people trode upon him in the gate, and he died. So where does this leave us in this story? This was the single most improbable outcome that could have taken place. From the start to the finish, this story would not have been predicted by anybody, but God said that he was going to take care of his people. Elisha said that. But these people did not trust in God. These people did not believe that God was going to provide for them. Now, I don't want you to hear this message tonight and think I'm preaching a name it and claim it gospel. That's not at all what I'm saying. I'm not preaching a prosperity gospel here. What I am teaching you is to trust in God even when it seems unlikely. Even when you say there's no way that God can solve the situation, God can. So we have a few points of application here. The first one is don't doubt that God will do good. Don't doubt that God will do good. I find so often in our lives, we don't pray for things because we simply believe that God won't answer our prayers. We don't expect God to work good in our lives. We've set the bar, the standard so low for what we expect of God that we said, you know what, God wouldn't do that. We think of that coworker at work that's rejected you time and time again with the gospel, and you just go home and you tell your wife or your husband, you said, look, I don't think they're ever going to get saved. I don't think it's ever going to happen. Why do we sometimes expect that God will fail to do good? Why do we fail to expect that God is going to take care of his people? Why do we expect that the gospel will no longer work? So sometimes people doubt that God will do good. The next thing is don't stress. This sounds super easy, but I want you to think about this. If you can't do anything about it, then don't stress. If you can't do anything about your problem, then don't worry about it. What's stressing going to do? If it's outside of your hands, then you can't do anything about it. So don't stress. Don't keep worrying about it if it's out of your hands. Trust God. Trust that God is going to take care of that situation. And if you can do something about it, also don't stress, because you have a solution. If you have a solution, then go enact the solution. So you see a solution to your problems. There is no reality in which you should continue to stress about these things. It's either in your control, where you can do something about it, in which case you shouldn't stress, or it's outside of your control. So don't stress about it. Now, the application is much harder. It's a very simple truth, but it's hard to do. I think of so many times where I've been stressed in my life, and I just continue to stress about it, even though there was something I could do. I remember one time when I was in high school, I had a Honda Civic. It was red. It was actually a year older than the one I currently have. I love that car. But when I bought that car, it had this really bad water leak in one of the A-pillars by the front windshield. And so I took my car apart one afternoon. I took the entire interior out, all the carpet, all the seats. I took the dash out, steering wheel, center console, gear shift. I took literally everything out of my car all the way down to the bare metal. And then I sealed the car. And I remember going to bed that night, and I did not sleep at all the entire night. I stayed awake all night stressed about that car because I started thinking, like, well, what if I can't get it put back together tomorrow? What if I lost a part? What if I broke something taking it out? What if my car explodes? And I started thinking all these irrational situations because of what I did. But I had a solution. I had something that I could do about it. I didn't need to stress about it anymore. And you know what? Even if I couldn't get it put back together the next day, life is going to continue. Life is going to move on whether I solve the problem or not. So why am I continuing to doubt that God will take care of me? Why do I continue to doubt or stress about situations when God has either given me a solution or has told me not to worry about this? So don't stress. And the last thing is don't miss out waiting for the perfect opportunity. You look at the king in this passage and you see the situation he was in. He's literally been given a golden ticket to solve the problem, which is that the Syrians have left their camp. All this food is just sitting there. All the resources they need to continue on and to thrive are just literally right there for the taking. And he's skeptical of it. He doesn't believe that God would do such a thing, even though God's prophet had literally told him this exact situation would happen. But he fails to believe him. And he's skeptical of God's provision. Do you think maybe he was just waiting for God to open a window? You think maybe he was expecting some even more far-fetched way? How did he believe that God was going to take care of him? And my assertion would be that he just didn't believe at all, that he did not trust that God was going to provide for his people. He missed out waiting for the perfect opportunity. I have one closing illustration that will be done. In the late fall of 1994, a man named DeWitt Finley, he was a camper salesman, was on his way to Grants Pass in Oregon. Instead of going directly there, he takes a more scenic route It's the Siskiyou National Forest. And so he's driving through there. This is the age before GPS and before cell phones and things like that. And as he's driving through this pass, he takes this scenic route and ends up getting kind of stuck on the snow. And so the road is a little bit slick, and he says, you know what, I'm going to just pull off the road here. And so he pulls off of the road, and he's sitting on the side of the road. Well, that night and for the next two nights, this massive blizzard comes in and completely covers his truck with snow. So his entire truck, all the way from the roof to the tires, is buried in snow. There's no way out. And so this man is thinking, gracious, he's like, I'm really stuck here. But he was a believer. And he says, you know what? He says, God's going to get me out of this situation. He said, God's going to take care of me. He says, I don't need to do anything. And so he sits in his camper, and he had a notepad. It was a yellow legal pad, and he was writing each day his journal of what he was going through each day. And so he would sit in the truck, and then he'd go to sleep, And the next day he would sit in the truck and he would go to sleep. And he has no food, no water inside the truck. What he would do is he'd record that he would take the snow from outside the window, and then he would pack it down and he would like melt it in his truck and he would drink that. And so he stayed hydrated. And even after the snow had melted, like in large portion, his truck was still a little bit stuck in the mud and he couldn't quite get out. But he continued to stay in this truck. He says, you know what? He says, God will provide a way for me to get out of this truck. He said, God will provide a way for me to get to safety. And so the days turn into weeks, and the weeks begin to turn into months. And so this man has been like spending week after week after week sitting in this truck, even though he could have gotten out of the truck and he could have gone and walked up the road and maybe looked for some help or something. He says, you know what? And he records this in his journal. He said, God's going to get me out of the situation. God's going to provide the way for me to escape. Well, it would happen in May of 1995 that two teenagers were also driving on that road. So the road is drivable at this point. They're driving up the road and they find this truck and they find this camper sitting in the back of it. Now you may be asking why he didn't climb into the camper in the back. It was just a display model, so it wasn't intended to be lived in yet. It wasn't insulated or anything. It was just the shell. But they come up on this truck and trailer and then they walk up to the window and they see the deceased body of DeWitt Finley sitting in the cab of the truck. And he had stayed alive in that truck for 58 days trying to just wait. And he said, you know what? He said, God will get me out of the situation. He said, God's going to get me out of here. He says, I don't have to do anything. The Lord will just take me out of here. What DeWitt Finley did not realize was that if he had walked just a few hundred feet up the road, there was an interstate, or there was a public road that was plowed every single day, and that there were multiple cars going down. His safety was just a few hundred feet away from him. But he kept passing up his perfect opportunity. He says, you know what? I'm going to wait for the exact moment that the rescuers are going to come in and they're going to find my truck and then they're going to pull me out of here. They're going to bring me to safety. And he failed to take any action of his own. Instead of stewarding the opportunities and the resources that God had given him, he kept pushing those away, waiting for something better. And sometimes I wonder if we often do the same. Trusting in God does not mean that you ignore all of your responsibilities. Trusting in God does not mean just throwing caution to the wind and living however you want. Trusting in God means making the most of the resources that he has entrusted you with. And trusting, making the most of the responsibilities he's given you. How many times have you not witnessed to a coworker because you're waiting for the perfect opportunity? How many times have you withheld the gospel from somebody because you just wanted that perfect moment? Or maybe you failed to do good for somebody because you thought, well, maybe it'll mean more to them next week, and then it just never happens. And so we keep pushing off these opportunities that we have, hoping for something perfect to come along. You didn't see the lepers do that in the story. The lepers said, you know what? We're going to go out and we're going to do something. And the Lord ended up using those lepers to save the entire city. But then you see the king. It's so interesting that you have someone who's the very bottom of the barrel of society contrasted with the person who was most in charge of society. And the people who had nothing, they said, you know what? We're going to go out and do something. We're going to go take action. And the king says, we're just going to sit here and die. So my challenge to you is this. What are you guys going to do with your opportunities? I challenge you to trust in God, but I also challenge you to trust that God will use your work for his glory, that God will use your efforts. Are you waiting for God to make a window? Let's pray. Lord, thank you for this day. We thank you for all that you've given us. Thank you for this passage of scripture. Lord, and the challenge that we have, we see that oftentimes we doubt you, Lord. We say that there is things that are outside of your control, or maybe that it's just so unlikely that it would never happen. God, we fail to believe that you would take care of us, that you would hold to your promises. But Lord, I just ask you'd give us faith that no matter how improbable our situation is, no matter how difficult things are, that we would trust in you. And Lord, that we would properly steward the responsibilities that you have given us, that we'd make the most of the opportunities that we have. We ask that you would burden our hearts this week, that we would not pass up opportunities waiting for the perfect one to come along, or, Lord, that just the perfect situation would come about so that we could do what you have already commanded us to do. Lord, give us boldness for the gospel. Give us boldness to witness to others, and let us glorify you in all that we do. In Jesus' name we pray. Amen.